Miller versus the State of Texas. Y'all ready?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, Deborah. Scott. Ready?
Hey, please, court. Counsel for the state.
Scott, I'm not sure I understand your arguments. Okay, there was a warrant for his arrest, right?
And so
it didn't matter whether there was a traffic. Did it matter whether there was a traffic violation? If there was a warrant for his arrest?
Those are two different issues. And going back and reading Mr. Llewellyn's brief, perhaps I wasn't clear enough on the argument. Those are two separate issues. I'm not, in that point, making any sort of reference that the officers indicated they stopped him for any sort of traffic offense.
Okay.
There's a notation within, or there's a paragraph within the arrest warrant itself where Investigator Johnson indicates that on August 6th of 2007, he ordered or requested another officer to stop Mr. Miller.
Okay.
And after that stop, he indicates that he interviewed Mr. Miller, and that statement from Mr. Miller is then a paragraph.
The basis for the warrant?
It's a paragraph in the arrest warrant.
Okay.
And so my point is that paragraph within the four corners of the arrest warrant, that paragraph was obtained illegally because on August 6, 2007, Investigator Johnson had no reasonable suspicion to believe that Mr. Miller, the appellant, had committed any sort of traffic offense, nor at that time was there a warrant out for his arrest. And the testimony on the record from Investigator Johnson would support that position, that all he did was he said, I told this other officer to pull him over that day.
Have you ever received the, referred to what I've got here, the encounter with the appellant's father, which was recorded, or the interview which was recorded?
No, and that's a
all
point
right.
I wanted to...
We'll ask the state in a minute why not. Okay.
As I can tell from your questions and going back and looking over, every time I go look at this case, it's convoluted. It's very complicated, but it kind of boils down to this. If we start with the arrest warrant, because the arrest warrant is the reason that the officers used to arrest Mr.
That's
Miller.
August 15th. That
yeah.
Warrant is August 15th.
The warrant itself was issued on August 7th. Okay.
On the 7th, and they
yes.
didn't execute it until the 15th?
That's Defense Exhibit Number 1.
Yeah.
In this.
Yeah, okay,
in,
I see that.
In the record. And
yeah.
The timeline looks like this, and the timeline is all laid out in Investigator Johnson's arrest warrant. He says that he received information on June 13th, 2007, that a generator had been stolen from Blue Sky Oilfield Services. He indicates that on July 31st, so a little over, about 6 weeks later, Investigator Johnson, in his arrest warrant affidavit, says he interviewed Michael Brooks. He interviewed him on an unrelated incident. At that point, and this is all within the four corners of the arrest warrant, Brooks says he has knowledge of a stolen generator. Michael Brooks, according to the arrest warrant affidavit, says that Cecil Eric Williams, Jerry Timms, and Richard Salzman stole the generator. But Brooks specifically says in the arrest warrant affidavit, Brooks says, I wasn't involved. I did not assist them in that. So you can infer that all of Brooks' information came from hearsay, which will become important in the analysis. The next paragraph in the arrest warrant affidavit states that on August 2nd, 2007, Investigator Johnson interviewed Michelle De La Cruz at PCSO, Parker County Sheriff's Office. And again, he says he was questioning Ms. De La Cruz on an unrelated incident. According to the arrest warrant affidavit, De La Cruz provided information regarding the stolen generator. She says that she, Jerry Timms, and Cecil Eric Williams stole it. She says that this Richard Salzman was not present, although Brooks had said Salzman was present. The next paragraph of importance within the arrest warrant affidavit states, on August 6, 2007, Jerry Timms was interviewed at Parker County Sheriff's Office by Investigator Johnson. And essentially, he says the same thing as Michelle De La Cruz, that De La Cruz, Timms, and Williams stole the generator. The next paragraph is when we were talking about it first, where Investigator Johnson indicates that he spoke to the appellant on August 6, 2007, and that's when the appellant, according to the arrest warrant affidavit, says, yeah, these guys called me, Dela Cruz, Timms, and Williams, on an evening, and I went out and inflated a tire for them, and then I left. That's all in the affidavit. That warrant then is executed on August 15, 2007, when the officers are heading to these three pieces of property that are described in the search warrant. But the arrest warrant is really the key issue, because what's going to flow from the arrest warrant is going to be a custodial interview of the appellant that has some admissions on it. So the arrest warrant being invalid, that's a key issue. Now, to be valid, an arrest warrant affidavit must provide the magistrate with sufficient information to support an independent judgment that probable cause exists to believe that the suspect committed a crime. Now, the standard of review is obviously highly deferential. All the cases say that, but it's not just a rubber stamp. The standards used to judge the showing of probable cause are the same for arrest warrants as they are for search warrants. You look at the totality of the circumstances, according to Gates. Every fact situation is different, case-by-case analysis, and you look at the four corners of the affidavit. Gates makes it clear the affidavit must provide a substantial basis for concluding the search warrant, or the arrest warrant in this case, provides probable cause. The magistrate must be presented with sufficient information to allow them to determine probable cause. The magistrate's action can't just be a mere ratification of conclusions on the part of the affiant. And the cases are clear that an informant's veracity, reliability, and the basis of her knowledge are still highly relevant. So if you look at the details of this arrest warrant, what you find is essentially it's just statements by Dela Cruz, Timms, and Brooks that they committed this offense. And then at the last minute, they just drop the appellant in and say, oh, yeah, he was there too. The Lowry case that's cited in the brief is on point. That's at 843 Southwest 2nd, 136, at page 141. And it specifically says that probable cause does not arise by the virtue of the fact that several people whose reliability, credibility, or basis of their knowledge is unestablished give the officers information concerning criminal activity. That's exactly what we have here. We've got the investigator talking to three admitted criminals in the Parker County Sheriff's Office. They essentially confess, and then they say, well, this guy's involved too. That would be like if I'm interviewed and I say, well, yeah, yesterday I sold a kilo of cocaine to my friend. Oh, and, you know, Justice Dofano was there too. It's the same thing. There's no basis for it. There's no credibility. There's no veracity. There's no reliability. There are cases out there that the appellate acknowledges and the state cites. We cite them in our brief that a statement against penal interest is a factor. It's a factor that the court can consider. It's not the end of the analysis. It's just a factor in the totality of the circumstances. It says that a statement against penal interest may be considered reliable, but in the context of the affidavits in the Abercrombie case, the Mejia case, it says you have to look at those in conjunction with everything else. Also, hearsay upon hearsay may be used to show probable cause, but only as long as the underlying circumstances indicate there's a substantial basis for crediting the hearsay at each level. So if you go back to our arrest warrant affidavit, you have Michael Brooks saying, yeah, these people stole this generator, and then later Jerry Miller, the appellant's involved. Well, that's hearsay, because he then says, I wasn't there, I wasn't involved, and that's in the affidavit. So there's no substantial basis to credit his reliability in that hearsay upon hearsay. We talked about how the appellant got arrested, and this is a very interesting point. The testimony on this was wildly different. There were two separate hearings on this motion to suppress. We had a day of hearing on March 20th, 2008, when, March 20th, 2008, when Investigator Hilliard, who wrote the search warrant, on the stand unequivocally states, when Mr. Miller, the appellant, was arrested on August 15th, 2007, he was arrested on this arrest warrant that we've been talking about. I specifically ask him that. He's given the opportunity to say, oh, well, we arrested him for these other reasons, too. Nope, doesn't say it. Well, then there's about a six-month break in which time the appellant filed a trial brief on the issues, and then the state asked to reopen evidence, and Hilliard gets back up on the stand in September, and now all of a sudden the appellant was arrested on August 15, 2007 because we knew he was driving a stolen car. Well, I specifically asked him, did you put that in your offense report? You arrested him for a stolen car? Nope. What we put in our offense report was we arrested him on the arrest warrant, and after we arrested him on the arrest warrant, another officer looked at the VIN number, and we figured out the car was stolen. That's what he says on the stand.
Okay, Scott, this is what I see as part of the problem, and that is in determining sufficiency of the evidence, we can do a factual sufficiency review. But in determining the propriety of denying a motion to suppress or dealing with search warrants, do you know of any authority that allows us to perform a factual sufficiency review? Or does that just go to how much deference we give?
I think it goes to how much deference you can give the trial court. And my concern in this case is that we're seeing over and over again the improprieties that the officers have engaged in. And the court seems to gloss over that, the trial court does. And it's up to this court as the higher authority to look down and say, well, trial court, you may believe that officer's credible. You may see him in your court every day because you're in Parker County. But based on what I see here, if I look at all the inconsistencies, this changing of testimony just to fit some new theory, and I think it's logical to assume that the reason that changes is because the appellant was alleging an illegal arrest, and the appellant, based upon the insufficiencies of the arrest warrant, and the appellant had already filed a trial brief, and at that point, that's when this new theory comes up that the appellant was arrested because of an independent factor of driving a stolen truck. And logically, it doesn't make sense because we also know that on August 9th of 2007, Investigator Hilliard attached a tracking device to this same allegedly stolen truck. So, if the officers have in their mind on August 15th that this is a stolen truck the appellant's driving, they don't need to go look very far to find him. They have a tracking device on it. They'll just go arrest him and say, look, appellant, we know you're driving a stolen truck. We're arresting you. So it defies logic.
It depends on what they want to search. When they arrest him depends on what they want to search.
But the search warrant requested property. The search warrant didn't deal with...
Yeah, but the search incident to arrest, I mean, you know that. You wait until they're where you want to search, and then you arrest them there so you can search where they are. I mean, that...
I agree with that in a number of cases, but in this specific case, if you look at all the glaring inconsistencies and the Hilliard's, the testimony from his own mouth. And so then we move forward. It's our position that his arrest was illegal because of the unconstitutional or the arrest warrant without probable cause. And then we roll forward to his confession that's taken. And it's our position that under all the factors that the confession, the statement is the fruit of the poisonous tree. There's no attenuation. The only intervening factors are that the man's been paraded in front of his wife and kids in handcuffs, taken to a jail, put in a cold cell, and deprived of food and for quite a few hours.
Can you explain why they took him in front of his wife and children, unhandcuffed him and recuffed him?
They don't explain it, but I think the overriding sort of theme or factor through this is, for whatever reason, these investigators are not viewing this as just a job. I think you can read.
Sheriff's Department or Police Department?
It's the Weatherford Police Department.
Who's chief now?
Well, you got me on that, Judge.
Still Blaisdell? No? Okay.
So the key issues, although there are other issues to be involved that are involved in the search warrants, and you can read the search warrant affidavits, and they have the same deficiencies that the arrest warrant affidavit has. The key issue in this case is the illegality of the arrest that led to the statement. So based upon that, the appellant would ask for a reversal of the trial court's ruling.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. It's Mike Manning. He's ex-Fort Worth PD. He's now the—
What's his name?
Michael Manning.
Manning, okay.
Is now the chief of police. He's also ex-Fort Worth PD like Jerry Blaisdell was. He's been with us 18 months or so, maybe not quite that long. Chief Blaisdell's now city manager. Yes. He was assistant city manager, and then there was a big flap over electric rates in the city with
okay.
our municipal loan. And
okay.
Anyway. So
tell us about the non-production of the videotapes and the recording.
Of the videotape. It's
I'm
my
sorry,
understanding.
Of the recordings with his father, the recordings of the interview.
Okay.
I mean,
it's my understanding.
There's a dispute about whether the father gave consent or not.
Sure.
And so even though there's a dispute and you haven't recorded, we don't have the recording.
My understanding, and this is outside the record, that was never provided to the DA's office because it could never be located. There was testimony in the record that both officers who are actually narcotics officers, this is a special crimes unit. This is a collaborative agency between sheriff's office and police department, but then case investigators in this case were with the sheriff, or the police department, Weatherford Police Department. And those two experienced narcotics officers did have a body bug when they go out to do the consensual search for the motorcycle. They testified that they did go ahead and record it, but that was not presented. They were saying, I don't know, did you have it? I don't have it. We never found it, to be honest with you. We just don't know, and it never really came up as far as an issue before this court or before the trial court about, well, you need to present this. You need to go turn that PD upside down, find that tape. There's not been any allegations of any Brady evidence or anything like that, but you're absolutely right. That would have made our job in this point much easier if I'd had the hardcore recording. What did you or did you not say with regard to that? But then again, appellant, with all due respect, has kind of glossed over the whole standing issue. That's consent by a third party for his own property that he testified to at the suppression hearing he owns. That's separate and apart from appellant. So really, just to answer
but
your question.
He didn't give consent, that he withdrew consent.
He's saying he gave consent initially for search of a stolen motorcycle that the officers were there originally. That's
right.
One of the four indicted cases. Then he testified, appellant's father, I withdrew my consent.
Right.
The officers counter conflicting testimony. Both of them said he gave us consent to search the property for the motorcycle, never withdrew it at any time. That was the conflicting information before the trial court.
And it's tape recorded, and the tape recording has disappeared.
I have no explanation as to that. I apologize.
What about the interview that was recorded?
Okay, are we talking about in reference to point error number two, or what specifically would you like to know, Judge, about
well,
that?
Was it recorded and was it produced?
Yes, it was recorded and produced, and it was admitted into evidence at the suppression hearing.
All right, then my note is incorrect here.
By appellant. It was introduced as the fruit that's trying to be suppressed. That was orally recorded in the bench briefs by particularly the state, which I've incorporated in this brief due to space constraints. I gave the court a couple time references to that particular exhibit that counter or that conflicts or rebuts allegations with regard to promises.
So that interview, any interviews with investigators and Mr. Miller were produced, were recorded, and were produced.
Except for what was referenced in the arrest warrant, this initial traffic stop that was the basis for that. My understanding, or I have no idea, there was no testimony developed whether or not there was a dash cam or body bag by the trooper, or I'm sorry, by the sheriff's deputy that pulled him over and conducted that interview. So I don't want to say blanketly or globally that, yes, everything was produced. But the actual oral statement with the admissions that we're trying to use against him or would have used if he had not pled guilty after the suppression ruling was actually produced timely. That's part of our standard discovery order. We have to comply with that.
And as I understand the complaint, too, when they pulled him over for the traffic stop with no traffic, that they say there was no traffic violation to support, he wasn't free to go, right? Because...
Well, I kind of want to disagree a little bit with Mr. Brown's characterization of the testimony there. the record was not developed as to, because we didn't call the officer who actually pulled him over for alleged traffic offense. There was testimony from the person who notified the deputy, the traffic deputy, to pull him over. That, yes, that's our normal MO, that's the way we do it. Follow him, find a traffic offense, and pull him over. But there was no direct testimony about whether there was or was not a traffic offense as a basis for the initial stop that then developed into the oral conversation that then ended up into the arrest warrant.
So if he's not free to go, if he's stopped for a traffic violation, then he's not free to go.
I would agree with that. If there was no basis for that detention, it becomes illegal detention. We can't use this oral statements even in a warrant.
No. Whether you're free to leave, I mean, whether it's a legitimate traffic stop or an illegitimate traffic stop, while you are stopped for a traffic stop, you are not free to leave because then that would be fleeing, right?
True. Correct.
Okay. So did they provide any warnings? Because if you're not free to leave, then you're in custody. So it's a custodial interrogation. Did they provide him any warnings before they took this statement that they used as the basis in part for the warrant?
I apologize again, Your Honor. You've caught me cold because I don't remember any reference to that because, like I said, there was no testimony about that independent first stop that ended up in the arrest warrant. There's just simply no evidence in the record one way or the other, so I can't answer that question. I don't know. There wasn't a recording. There wasn't any testimony. I've not spoken with the trial prosecutor specifically about that prior stop that's in the basis of the warrant, but just for the court's information, there was explicit evidence in the record testimony that at the time that the arrest warrant was served, there was no traffic stop because appellant was the one who pulled over to get out to talk to see who these two guys in this pickup, unmarked pickup, were following him. So he came over. The officer, arresting officer that served the arrest warrant and made the arrest at the time of the scene, knew the appellant by sight, made the arrest, and went on down the road. So that's where I apologize to Mr. Brown. I completely missed, like you did, Judge, what his argument was and where he was coming from that, because there's testimony that there was no actual traffic stop at the time of the actual arrest warrant. And then he was taken from there back to the scene of the searches, which was not too far away.
Why?
And then the search warrants were served.
After they had him arrested, why did they take him back in front of his wife and children and uncuff him and then cuff him in front of his wife and children?
I couldn't speak to that other than just knowing normal police procedures. Again, this is all outside the record, but he was arrested off-site. They took him back because they had search warrants in hand to search property connected to him, three different parcels. They took him back for the purposes of the search because part of the arrest team was also part of the search team. So I think they just secured appellant at the scene. They probably uncuffed him knowing these officers. They conducted their search, and then once
it
was time to transport
him, search?
He was present during the search of the three premises, yes. And then after that, this is appellant's testimony. Then they recuffed him, put him in a patrol car, and took him to jail.
Okay, what about the fact that they had a warrant to search something that was very close to the fence, and they claimed they saw a vehicle, and I got the wrong case, without a VIN, way, way far away, and they...
Well, there was conflicting evidence as to that. What you're talking about is what's in the search warrant affidavits. There are actually two 1995 white Dodge pickup trucks here. One has missing VIN plates. That was eyeballed by the officer, the affiant at the search warrants. He also confirmed seeing that same truck without the VIN plates that he saw in the consensual search with the appellant's father. The second time he went to premises number three and placed a court-ordered tracking device on the alleged stolen truck to keep tabs of him because we were trying to find the stolen generator on the big trailer. I mean, this is a big $40,000 huge piece of equipment that was stolen as part of one of the warrants. One of the cases. And at that point, when he crawled over the fence in the middle of a hayfield to attach the mobile tracking device, that's the Dodge pickup that was near the fence, he saw the same, or what looked to be the same, white Dodge pickup truck without the VIN plates or license plates sitting in the same hayfield that he saw on premises place number two at an earlier occasion that was then owned and given consent to by appellant's father. And that was also part of this whole deal, trying to find out, well, where's the stolen Toyota Tacoma pickup? where's this stolen Dodge pickup that we're trying to find? Because we have information to believe that the appellant's now driving a stolen Dodge pickup truck. Then there's this other one that happens to be registered to appellant without its VIN plates, kind of putting two and two together. He's driving a stolen vehicle, covering it up by having exact same make and model VIN plates removed off his personal rightfully owned vehicle and placed on the stolen vehicle. Come to find out after the arrest, that is what happened. He was caught driving a stolen pickup truck with the VIN plates from his own personal vehicle. So that's kind of how all that worked out.
Is there a written consent to search?
No.
By the father?
And I wish they'd have had that as well. That would have made that simpler. It would have.
So you're relying on the oral, or the police relied on the oral consent, both for the fact of the consent and the scope of the consent and whether the consent was withdrawn. And it...
Okay, I know this recorded. Kind of gets convoluted. I'm sorry to interrupt. Were you finished, Judge?
No, it was recorded, but the recording wasn't that they're of everything they're relying on for the consent search has disappeared.
Search of father's place, yes. We can't find the tape of the body mug recording of when they went out to talk to appellant's father. Can we search your place for the stolen motorcycle, finding the truck? And yes, that is in the search warrant affidavits.
Okay. In civil law, the rules about spoliation are pretty clear. Do you know what the rules about spoliation in criminal law are?
I apologize, Judge. That is above my pay grade. That's out of my realm of experience. I can't even speak to that. Sorry. But I want to be clear for the court, and that's why I tried to be very clear in the brief as much as I could. We're kind of mixing, and Mr. Brown kind of did it this morning, too. I want to be very clear. We're not mixing apples and oranges on the different standards of review. We actually have three here. The standing issue is de novo. It's an issue of law after the trial court's made the historical findings of fact. But then you have the Carmouche and Guzman bifurcated standard of review typically found in suppression hearings with regard to the finding on the oral statement exceeding the scope of the consent. I'm sorry, the scope of the warrant. Those are the issues that need to be addressed and handled under that standard review. But when you're reviewing, like you had mentioned, alluded to in appellant's argument, when you're dealing with the propriety of a magistrate's determination of PC to issue a warrant, you have to be highly deferential. We're basically dealing with probabilities. Was the four corners sufficient proof in and of itself? So we don't get into any of this inconsistencies, trial testimony that's different, trial testimony that might have changed, stuff that might have been lost. All of that is separate and apart. We have to look at the warrants, and was there sufficient basis in those warrants, affidavits, to authorize the issuance of the warrants?
The one there, Frank's hearing?
There's also a Frank's issue as part of this. It was all kind of globbed in there together. Appellant argues that the three statements that were false in the search warrant affidavits is, one, father said I never gave consent. Two, that the officer who went out to place the mobile tracking device on the alleged stolen pickup could have, or when he was out there doing that, he could have even physically seen truck number two in the same hayfield. Appellant testified that that's actually on the back 40 of this 200-acre plot. He could not have seen that. That's that allegation. And then three, it escapes me right now. Because of allegations in the arrest warrant affidavit being silent as to who asked this group of people to go steal the stolen generator is not in that affidavit, but yet the allegation in the search warrant affidavit that says that, well, we went and stole it because the appellant asked us to. He's saying that that's the allegation of the third, or the context of the third allegedly false statement. State's response to all of that, it's all set forth in the brief, is that he failed to show the falsity of any of those statements. With regard to the first two, there was directly conflicting evidence. Yes, I consented, and I withdrew it. No, he never did consent. Also, the father said, truck was never even there that day. So you had those conflicting testimonies when you have two officers saying, it was there, we looked at it, we talked about it, he told us appellant's the one that brought it out there. And then you have father's testimony that no, it never happened. Again, conflicting credibility call. So there again, because our argument with regard to the Franks is that he did not show it was falsity, therefore we can't throw out or excise any of the allegations in the warrants with regard to that. I just want to rely on my brief as far as point two, but all this talk about the warrant is really kind of ancillary to another reason. They had probable cause to believe an arrest on site for the two extra warrantless offenses that were being committed in their presence. Stolen truck or UUMV and tampering with the identification number. That's what these warrants were for, were to investigate evidence of tampering with vehicle identification numbers. Officers saw that at the suspected places. He knew that there was a registered vehicle. There was only one registered vehicle to appellant. It's exactly the same as the alleged stolen truck that ultimately he was found in. And so when you got that information given to arresting officer who was also on the search team privy to all that information, the state's counter-argument or alternate argument is that there was valid PC to make an arrest for offenses committed with the officer's presence in addition to the search warrants. I'm sorry, in addition to the arrest warrant. So based on that, if the arrest is legal, then the statement's admissible at that point.
Mr. Judge.
Oh, yes. He looked like he had a question.
I do have a question. How do you arrive at a Cole jail cell on August the 15th in the Parker County Jail?
Escapes me, Your Honor, to be honest with you. I don't know. I just cited the court two cases where the Court of Criminal Appeals say the physical confinement conditions aren't really relevant unless you can show something extreme.
May not be relevant. I'm curious. And I just want to.
Well, it's a concrete building, so in that sense, I think it could be pretty cold. I mean, they do have air conditioning, but yes, I don't know how it could be to the point where your will could be overborne for due process purposes in giving a statement or choosing not to give a statement because in August, your jail cell is just too cold.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Judge. Anything else? I'll shut up. Appreciate it.
Justice, I'd like to just address a few issues that Mr. Llewellyn talked about. Dealing with this, the recording or the lack of the recording, whether that's an issue or not, the recording of the encounter with the father on August 3rd or August 5th, 2007, I think what's important here, it's a credibility issue. The officers, Peel and Hilliard, both went out of their way at the second hearing to say, hey, we have a recording of this, Judge. That's going to show we're right. And they both say that. It's at volume 3, page 46 and 48.
Yeah, but it also argues lack of standing.
Right. And the standing issue is interesting because if you go to what the appellant or the appellee concedes that the appellant has standing to challenge the search of the home on suspected place 1, then the appellee notes in support of their argument that the appellant has no standing to challenge suspected place 2, he says that in the affidavit to support the search warrant, the investigator actually includes in his affidavit that the appellant and his father own suspected place 2, that they own it. But then the state wants to contradict their own investigator and say, well, that's not really true because there was no testimony to that. So again, it's a case of the state putting forth contradictory positions on that issue.
So their position was it was joint ownership, and that's what connected the appellant to any property found on the location.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it would be the father's property.
But then after the testimony and the state decides they want to have a contradictory position, which the court is aware that the state cannot put forth contradictory positions just to satisfy their own needs. The issue of whether the traffic stop on August 6, 2007 was mentioned in the record, it actually is. We covered that, volume 2, page 63.
Mr. Brown, would you address the standing issue on suspected place number 3?
Suspected place number 3, Your Honor, I think I will concede that is probably the state's best argument as far as lack of standing and also on the open fields testimony. The reality in this case is that of the four indicted cases, none of the property was recovered from suspected place 3, and so that might become a point that's sort of moot anyway.
Thank you.
Again, it's as far as the state jumping back and forth, though, it's interesting that the investigator does go out of his way in his affidavit to link the appellant to everything, and the state wants to change their mind later. I believe Mr. Llewellyn's argument a few minutes ago supports my position on the arrest on August 15, 2017, where Mr. Llewellyn agreed that the officers figured out after the appellant was arrested on the arrest warrant August 15, 2007, after that they figured out that these VIN numbers had been switched. So this whole testimony that they had valid probable cause other than the arrest warrant It would have been sure easy for Officer Hilliard at the very first hearing to just say that when specifically asked, why did you arrest Mr. Miller, the appellant, on August 15, 2007? He says, on the arrest warrant. I put that in my offense report. We figured out the vehicle was stolen later. You really had the valid PC. It's not hard to say that. So, again, the appellant believes that the record in this case, the arrest warrant, search warrants are invalid, and we would request a reversal.
Y'all didn't attach the warrants to your briefs, did you?
I don't believe we did, Your Honor. They are attached to the record.
Okay, let me tell y'all our problem. We've got one record.
I'll be happy to.
We got three judges, and so we have to arm wrestle each other to get that record. And if your case turns on something like a warrant or a confession, it really helps us to stay friendly up here if those things are attached to the brief, because then we each have our own copy and we don't have to share.
I apologize.
No. It's just.
And Your Honor, if it would please suggestion. The court, and I believe the state would agree, I'd be happy to supplement. First, give the state time to object to make sure that we have the right thing and present the. I'll give you extra copies.
Oh no, we'll just get the. We'll just make our own copies up here. But it's kind of nice to have them up here on the bench when we're talking about them and.
I agree, Your Honor.
So it's just a suggestion, just for what it's worth. Consider the source.
Thank you, Judge.
Okay. All right. We do appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. And your case is submitted. And appreciate you coming so far to argue. And you're excused to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.
Thank you.